Hi, this is Rich Scheidner. If you've ever wondered what it was like to be a stand-up comedian in the 1980s, I'm going to do you a big favor. Instead of billions of dollars for a time machine, you can just spend $24.95 and buy my new book, Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 1980s Comedy Boom. It will save you money and give you thrills. It will take you there. Go to my website, richscheidner.com. Go to amazon.com and buy this book.
Hi, this is Louie Cronin, author of Everyone Loves You Back, and you're watching Mr. Media.
I'm Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. You can see, hear, and read more than 1,000 of my previous celebrity interviews at MrMedia.com. That's MrMedia.com. Subscribe to the show on YouTube, iTunes, Apple News, Google Play, Stitcher, or any of those other places, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. On today's show, I'll talk to Louie Cronin, former producer of NPR's Car Talk show, who has branched out into novel writing with her first effort, Everyone Loves You Back. Stick around. Bob Bolan, at middle age, is a mess. Fortunately for him, the lifelong bachelor and radio station engineer has hit a sweet spot where every woman he's been meeting lately wants to fix him and make him all better. His co-worker, Irene, for example, and his neighbor, Liani. But Bob is just shuffling through life at this point, indecisive, indifferent, affable, but ultimately ineffable. Bob is at the core of Louie Cronin's first novel, the Cambridge, Massachusetts set story, Everyone Loves You Back. It's a charming, easy read, and I dare say we all probably have a Bob Boland in our lives somewhere. Now, making everyone ever more interesting is its workplace setting, an FM radio station in the throes of conversion from jazz to an all-news format. Now, that's particularly compelling because the author spent 10 years as the producer of Car Talk, the long-running NPR show hosted by Tom and Ray Magliazzi. How'd I do?
Good. That was good.
He said, betraying the fact that he hadn't listened to the show but once. more recently, she is a technical director for PRI's The World. Sorry, PRI. I'm guessing she must have been taking a lot of notes over the years. Louie Cronin, welcome to Mr.
Thank
Media.
You. Thank you.
So I love the title of your book, and I think that's probably because I can't read it or hear it without thinking of Ray Romano, who would probably be perfect to play Bob Bolan if there's ever a TV series or a movie.
Oh, no one's ever suggested Ray Romano. That's good. He's good.
Well, I mean, you know, everyone loves Raymond, so I keep coming back to...
Yeah, that's good. That's good, because I've had people think that Bob Bolan is not supposed to be attractive, but he is. He is supposed to be attractive.
Oh, and Ray is somewhere in the middle there.
Right. Well, no, he's attractive.
Well, he's 48 years old, right?
Right.
He spends a lot of time working at night, so I'm sure his pallor is a little pale, perhaps.
Exactly.
And he's a fixer up there. He's a fixer up project for some ambitious woman.
Right.
Maybe one who would like to get pregnant by a total stranger, perhaps.
Perhaps. Yes. Right.
Or one
right.
who's very desperate and just decides to throw herself one day at him. Someone like that. I got to ask, did you know or do you know a real Bob Boland?
No. He's really a creation of fiction. I mean, the closest person to him is probably me. I worked as a radio engineer for years and then as a producer. So, he's sort of me. But then he has parts of men I've met, men I know. He's sort of, and then he morphed into his own being. So,
and see, I was going to ask you if Irene or Liani was you, but you're
right.
Saying that you made the lead character, sort of.
I made the lead character. Yes. I mean, I think partly is I started the book with Bob Bolan's voice in my head. It's like he started ranting, and that was how the book started. So
okay.
He was ranting, and then all of a sudden I realized, oh my God, I've got a novel. I like this rant, but he's a man. I have to write in the voice of a man for this novel. So, I mean, I struggled, you know, I took from my own experience, but then I, you know, looked around me at men. I got men who were friends of mine to advise me when I went off track. So
did, have any men come forward and said, why did you write about me? any guys that you know recognize any traits of any kind?
One of my brothers came forward and said, is this me? And I said, no, it's really more me. But yeah, there are things about my brother that are similar to him too. So,
you know how I would answer that question? I would say, absolutely. Go tell everyone you know that there's a book written about you.
About you.
Tell them to buy 2 copies. It's small.
Right, right. Yeah. Right.
And so, so going back to the issue of the lead character, I mean, I'm thinking it would be difficult to write in the head of a woman. I mean, I just don't think I could do it. So, how do you write in the voice or the head of? I mean, it's not Bob Boland's voice first person, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. You know, you have to describe him pretty well, what he's thinking, how he's reacting. How do you get to that point? And did you rely on any men to read this and go, he wouldn't do that, or he would do that, or?
I did. I'm in a writing group, and I actually read the book to them chapter by chapter as I wrote it. So I often had times where the men in the group would say, no, he wouldn't care about what the guy had on. You know, like I had
right.
Describing somebody's clothes. They were like, no. And then they said, you know, he would be thinking more like who could take each other in a fight. Am I more dominant or him? So, you know, they corrected me as I went along.
Yeah, you got some good advice. I liked, and now that you're telling me this, it makes sense. I like that you reference how he, as he's holding Leonie. Did I say it right? I'm really
Leonie.
I'm so
Leonie. Yeah, like Briony.
Folks, you read it and figure out how you'd pronounce it. Okay, get off my back already. But I'm thinking, you know, there's a point when he like holds her close, and he loves the smell of her shampoo that she uses. You know, I mean, that's something a man would notice, I think.
Mm-hmm.
If maybe she smells like strawberries, or maybe she smells like, you know, something, you know, I could see that. But yeah, I mean, you find me a man who a woman walks by him, no matter how attractive she is, if he can tell you what color her hair was or what her shoes look like, that's not a real man. Sorry.
Right.
That's not a straight man, I'm afraid.
Once I took a writing class once, and there was somebody in the class who was writing a detective story in the voice, and it was a man, and he was writing in the voice of a woman. And the main character was a woman. And he at one point had the woman standing looking at herself naked while drinking a beer and thinking how good she looked. And every woman in the class went, no woman would ever do that.
Be the opposite, right? Be
like exactly.
Identifying all the imperfections. And,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Beating
yeah. So I did think about that when I was writing this. I thought about him and how, you know, I had to keep on trying not to, you know, use my point of view, you know.
There aren't graphic sex scenes by any means, but there are intimate scenes. Was it hard? Were those things kind of difficult to put yourself in the head of a man for doing that?
You know, I don't remember them being hard. They're pretty minor sex scenes. So, or not minor, they're important to the book and everything,
right.
But they're definitely not graphic or, you know.
Yeah, those corporate people at PRI, don't sweat this, okay?
Yes.
If you want to find someone in the media who's writing graphic sex scenes, look up Tamara Lush, okay? She's an AP reporter. Tamara, you're welcome. I don't know Cambridge very well, but mm-hmm. I know I've spent some time in Brookline, I've spent some time in Boston. It seemed to me that the descriptions of the people probably fit pretty well. Have you gotten any criticism that we people of Cambridge are not like that? I don't know what you mean. And excuse me while I go and meditate for a while.
So far I haven't. I mean, when I was writing the book, you know, some of my even the group members are from Cambridge. And, you know, I remember one of my group members saying, oh, this is feeling close. This is feeling uncomfortably close, you know.
That's good.
But, yeah, but so far, no, I haven't had anybody. I'm trying to think. His wife read it, too, and I'm trying to remember if she had anything like that. I don't think so, no. I'm hoping not.
No, I was disappointed that the back cover of the book does not have a disclaimer that no radio engineers' careers were damaged. By this book. So maybe you didn't work that angle hard enough.
Right.
So I got to ask, what do radio engineers, radio producers, what do they know about what goes on behind the scenes that the public has no idea?
Huh, that's a good question. I mean, I guess we know how last minute everything is and how thrown together everything is. That's one thing. I mean, we know how some people are really difficult, like people you might not expect are really difficult and people you wouldn't expect, you know, who I once did this thing with Charlton Heston, and it was a, you know, political thing. And I was definitely not on his side politically. I was definitely like rooting for the other guy. And Charlton Heston was the nicest man. He was just warm and kind. And the guy who agreed with me was not nice at all. So, and what else have I noticed? I mean, you get to see, you know, the people who are on the air, some of them have incredible egos and, you know, some of them don't. Like Tom and Ray were completely natural, just themselves. It totally unaffected by fame and everything like that.
See, and I was thinking, there's in your book, there's a constant undercurrent of the characters being worried about being fired day to day, and I'm thinking that is about as true to a radio station as you're going to capture. From my experience of my bare bones experience of college radio, but not so much that, but over the years I covered the radio industry for many years, and it seemed like that's just the only thing that's currency for everybody. You just don't know day to day walking in if you're going to, you know, if you're going to lose your job because the station changes its flavor, its format. Somebody woke up on the bad side of the bed, you know. So I thought that was really interesting.
Oh, I worked on this morning show, like a morning humor show. And one of the bits that the disc jockey used to do was he'd say, Louie, I see you're wearing your pink slip today. Because we were going through a really tumultuous time. And he was already the maybe third wave of people I had. So because you're I was always a union engineer, so I was a little more protected than the DJs. I think he was the third wave of DJs that I had been through because it had gone from disco to top 40 to progressive rock. So the guy who was – and he was fired eventually.
Of course.
Yeah.
So you are Bob Bolan because Bob Bolan was union.
Yes, book,
right?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. You can tell I read a little bit of the book.
Look, right? I know. I'm really impressed.
Two-thirds, because I don't give away the ending. So I will not finish reading it until after we finish the interview.
Good.
So that's, you know. So I won't tell everybody that Bob Bolan dies at the end.
Oh, good.
Did I say that out loud?
Uh-huh. You
Sorry.
Did.
Sorry about that, kid. How and one more question about radio in general, and I want to ask you about the Tom and Ray. But how, for someone who does not know, how would you explain the difference between working in a radio station and working in like a bank or a doctor's office or you know, big corporate place? Most people never even get inside a radio station, so they don't know. How is it different from a more common job experience?
Well, you know, I'll tell you this one thing. Once this station I worked in San Francisco, my sister came to visit and she said, oh, my God, this place feels like a dorm room or a frat house. I mean, nobody is dressed up. That's one thing. Everybody's dressed down and it doesn't matter what you look like at all or what you wear. I mean, At my current job, a lot of people are still dressed in their bicycling outfits,
really?
Cycling outfits. Yeah, they have cycling clothes on all day long. And I mean, I worked at this one radio station in the station where I met Tom and Ray, and I brought a friend of mine for a tour, and we went all around the business part, and then we walked into the studios, and she said, "Does the fact that everybody here is so sloppy correlate with how much money they make or anything?" You know, because so it's totally – so there's that. It's very relaxed and casual looking. The other thing is it's showtime. So it's more similar to theater, I would say, or, you know, like let's put on a show. Mm-hmm. So there is this, you know, incredible constant deadline, like the clock – is constantly ticking, and it's what's moving everybody, you know, through their day. And I mean, one station I worked at, you'd see people running in the hallways. I mean, flying as fast as they could to get to the studio in time and stuff. So it's got this sort of showtime fun theater thing going on. That's like the best part of it.
Okay.
I'd say.
It's a lot of energy.
A lot of energy and, yeah, a lot of, like, performance. It's like you feel like you're having, you know, the fun of putting on a show. Hmm. So.
All right. Well, yeah. Before we have to take a break, I want to ask you just a minute or two about Tom and Ray. You were there for a decade, so I'm assuming it was either a fun, profitable, or that they had something on you. Which was it?
It was fun. Yeah. I mean, it was kind of like, you know, everybody's dream job. Really, you know, really, really fun and also a very relaxed place to work. And yeah, it was totally fun. And Tom and Ray, I mean, I feel bad Tom is gone and I miss him so much. They both are wonderful. I mean, I think everybody loves them and loved them, you know, as much as fans did. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they're wonderful.
Okay,
and very funny.
So Tom or Ray, you can only pick one. It's Sophie's choice. Who do you pick?
Oh my God, I can't do that. I can't do it. I mean, I think when I first got to know them, I picked Tom. I would say I picked Tom because Tom is very outgoing and used to come over and talk to me and joke and laugh and stuff. So we were actually friends a little bit before I ever started working for him. And part of the reason we're friends is that I'm talkative and he's talkative. So he'd come walking into the show that I was working on and I'd start yakking and he'd start yakking. So, so I love Tom, you know, on site immediately. Ray, it's funny because I got to know Ray slowly, much more slowly, because he's much more quiet and more of a straight man. But he's every bit as smart and funny and wonderful. So
I got to say, I think you missed an opportunity here. It's Tom who passed
away, yes.
So it would have been so easy to just say, well, Ray. Because you know, so you went for Tom first, and now Ray's sitting at home watching this because I know that that's what he does. You know, he waits a week until the new episode posts, and he's sitting there going, "Come on, there's just me around. Pick me." Anyway, what would be something that fans of the show would not know about Tom and Ray that they would get a kick out of?
Let me think. I guess they'd know they were practical jokers. They were definitely, okay, I'll tell you, my first time going out to dinner, we would occasionally, you know, go out for dinner for celebrate somebody's birthday or, you know, a holiday party, basically. So the first time I went out with them, it was a big Italian dinner, not Italian dinner, it was at a Chinese restaurant. And after we'd had dinner, I got up and went to the bathroom. And so, you know, I just went to the bathroom. I came back and the entire group had left and left me with the check.
Wow.
So that was like, they did that every single time. And then they would just do it to see your reaction and then appear like from behind the door. So Every time we went out to dinner, they did stuff like that.
Wow. Well, all right, so last question, and then we're going to take a break and come back and talk about writing, believe it or not.
Yes.
From your 10 years, do you have any souvenirs from the show or from the guys that you've held on to? Anything that's particularly meaningful to you?
Let me think. What do I have?
An old beat-up hubcap? I don't know.
I know. Something like that. I'm trying to think what I have. I have lots of stuff, lots of swag from Car Talk, bags and hats and T-shirts. Okay, the best thing I have is a T-shirt that says Click and Clack for President in 2000.
Wow,
so,
that's cool.
Yeah, so I know that one's really rare.
Do you bring that out every 4 years? I mean, when...
Right.
When the show's off, is that what you're going to sleep in? I mean, that kind of thing?
No, I've got it saved somewhere in the basement.
Okay. All right. Is that where you keep Ray? Never mind. Sorry.
No.
That's misery. Sorry. That's confusing my novels.
That's misery. Yes.
All right. Well, folks, we're going to take a quick break here for a word from our sponsor, and we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Rich Scheidner. If you've ever wondered what it was like to be a stand-up comedian in the 1980s, I'm going to do you a big favor. Instead of billions of dollars for a time machine, you can just spend $24.95 and buy my new book, Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 1980s Comedy Boom. It will save you money and give you thrills. It will take you there. Go to my website, richscheidner.com, go to amazon.com, and buy this book.
All right, so we're back talking to Louis Cronin. I guess I have to ask you before I ask you about writing. Louis, L-O-U-I-E? I mean, where does that come from?
My real name, my full name is Mary Louise. And when I was a kid, I went by Mary Louise. And then I tried to go by Mary Lou. But my uncle had started calling me Louis when I was a little kid, and my brothers always called me Louie. So I would try to be Mary Lou, and then I'd have friends call the house, and my brothers would say, Louie, and Mary Lou would go. So, I mean, I finally just resigned myself to it. And now it seems so much more like me than Mary Lou.
I thought maybe it had something to do with breaking into the business, a very male-dominated business.
Right. No. I mean, I did notice at one point when I was first applying to writing grad school, I still was applying as Mary Lou. And one of my older brothers said to me, Mary Lou sounds stupid. Change it. Go to Louie. And I did find that when I first went to Louie, I felt like I got accepted for things better.
Interesting.
Yeah, I did think. And when I first started submitting the Everyone Loves You Back, I would have conversations with people, and of course they would assume I was a man, and I'd sort of forgotten about it.
So. You see a name and I got to tell you a funny thing, and I don't mean to embarrass your publicist, but we exchanged some emails, and she told me about your book, and I wrote back and I said that sounded interesting, and I said would he be available for an interview. And then she wrote back and said, Louis is she. I went, oh, okay. One more round of email. And the next time he used the pronoun he. After all that, right. And I didn't point it out, but I just thought it was funny,
anyway. Right, right.
So you've been living kind of this split life, right? I mean, you're a radio producer, engineer by day, writer by night. I know this is your first novel.
Yes.
But
yes.
You've been writing for years.
Yes, for years and years and years. Yes.
Why the split? Why not just, all writer or all radio?
It's funny. I mean, I think I did at times not work in radio. When I first started writing, I worked for a while as a proofreader and a copy editor.
Oh.
And, I did that for a while and I liked publishing, and then I worked doing editorial work and publishing for a while. I liked doing that and everything, but I always would be drawn back to a radio job. It's as though there was this excitement in the radio jobs. And one of the real reasons I ended up going from publishing back into radio too, was in publishing, if you talked, they knew you weren't working. So it wasn't like, you know, you were just sitting there and it was just you and your manuscript and your head down looking. And I think I'm a little bit more, I don't know, I need more stimulation or something. So I felt like, okay, the writing is quiet enough and solitary enough. So there was some, I remember when I first went back to radio and I took a tour of the station, the man who was interviewing me gave me a tour of the station, and we walked in and there was like this studio full of people sitting around just, you know, talking, gabbing. And I thought, oh, I like this.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
I noticed that when I covered radio for the newspapers, and, you know, it was always fun to go to the station. People are generally in a good mood. There's the energy that you were talking about before. There's always people moving around. I just always liked it.
Yep, yeah.
So were there any particular writers or teachers that influenced you, that kind of either directly or indirectly kind of guided you on the path?
Yeah. I mean, I've been very lucky. I think when I first started writing, I hooked up with this writing teacher in New York named Ruth Dannon. And she immediately said to me, so do you want to write commercial bestsellers or do you want to write art? Do you want it to be literary? And I said, you know, art, definitely. And she said, okay, so you have to have another job. That was the first thing. Wow. So you've got to figure out what else you're going to do, because you won't make any money if that's what you want to do. And so I mean, it was, she was a really, really great teacher. She also told me it's a 10-year apprenticeship. And I stretched that into like a 30-year apprenticeship. But she was a wonderful teacher and very, she was also a poet. So that sort of pushed me in a way that I knew I wanted to write fiction, and working with a poet was good for me because it pushed me to listen to words, and she'd always say, go deeper, deeper, you know. So anyway, and then I was really lucky to meet André Debuse, the short story writer. And I joined his writing group and was in, and I'm still in the group that he started. So I've been in that group since like 1995, I think, or 96. And he was also a wonderful teacher, really generous. And he had this amazing way to, like, when you wrote a story, you know, and even though we were just the, you know, the sort of supplicants at his feet, you write a story, he would just go, give it his all and go right into it. And, you know, he'd be so far into it, he'd be saying, you know, did she put the cigarette out yet? Or, he was very, very detail and very sensual detail oriented. So the first time I showed him a story I had written, he said, where's the sensual details? You know, it was as somebody was at a meditation retreat with, and he said, there's supposed to be incense and gongs and, you know, heat. And so anyway, he was a big, big influence.
Patchouli? I don't know.
Patchouli oil. Exactly.
All right. Yeah, because I've been to so many of those. Yes. Do you have a drawer full of unpublished manuscripts, or did you hit it on the first try?
Oh, I have a drawer full. I have a drawer full. This is my first novel. I started one once, but didn't get that far into it. I have a drawer full of short stories. Mm. But, I have lots and lots.
So will this commit you to maybe put those in a collection at this point, now that you've, you know, kind of broken through and published?
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, I always feel bad that I have this backlog of stuff that's sitting there that, you know, hasn't gotten out. And I'd love to put them together into a collection.
Well, in this day and age, it's not hard to get everything published.
Yeah.
You can do it yourself, obviously. There's other things. But you've got a publisher now, so you've taken it to that next step. So who was more excited about getting that first book, copy of the book in the mail? Was it you? Was it your husband? Was it somebody else? Who got really excited?
Well, you know what? I got the first book when I went to L.A. and met with Sean, my editor, and he had the books. So it was me.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely me. Right. I mean, I was like kind of looking at – I have it. I was kind of looking at it. I just couldn't believe it that I had a book.
Yeah. Try holding a radio station in your hand, right?
Right.
Oh, here's my radio show. Can you see it?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not the same thing.
It's not the same. No. I mean, when I first – too, when I would finish something and I'd have like a thick manuscript, I was like, you know, weighing it. Like, look at all that I have. So having a book is totally exciting.
Very, very cool. Very cool. Well, folks, listen. You can find Louis Cronin's first novel, Everyone Loves You Back. Like I said, I kind of picture Ray Romano as the main character. Ray, if you're watching, get in touch with Louis about rights. Anyway, you can find it in great stores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. You probably know how this works if you're watching on MrMedia.com or anywhere that you can find the show. Below the video, below the audio player, you will see a copy of the cover of the book. Just click on it, take it to Amazon. You can have it in 30 minutes or less via drone. I hear that's available in some areas. I've been kidding about that for a year, and in that time, now you can get same-day delivery of a lot of things. So, it's not that far off.
Right.
Louis, do you have a website? Are you on social media? Can people find
you? You know what? I have a website that'll be up soon, and it's louiscronin.com.
L-O-U-I-E.
Yes, louie.com, louiscronin.com. Yes,
folks, just look over here. I guarantee it's right here on the bottom of your screen. Don't rely on Louie because she obviously doesn't know what she's talking about.
Right.
Twitter, Facebook, any of that kind of stuff?
Twitter is at Louis Cronin.
Okay.
Facebook, Louis Cronin.
Good. Yeah, you got to have that stuff as a published author.
Yes.
No choice about it now.
I'm working on it.
All right.
Well,
Louis Cronin, it was delightful to talk to you, and thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Recorded live before a studio audience full of real radio veterans who can't believe anything characterized as a podcast ever gained traction in the media, in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Okay, before you go, I just want to remind you that Audible.com was our sponsor today, and you can get a free audiobook. A free audiobook with a 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audible.com/trynow. TRYNOW. Again, a free audiobook with a 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audible.com/trynow. I don't know about you, but that Johnny Cash biography, as read by Kris Kristofferson, I think I'm going to grab that one right now.